Welcome to the newsroom. I'm news reporter Kelly Kinoyer.
And I'm criminal justice reporter Aaliyah McConnell. Thank you for joining us.
I want you to imagine that you're the victim of some terrible crime, an assault, a violent robbery, being injured by a drunk driver. You've watched the people who hurt you go through the court process, and they've been put in prison. But deep down, your trauma hasn't healed.
Maybe you still feel haunted by what happened to you, looking over your shoulder, and you never got to hear the simplest thing, an apology from the person who hurt you.
The justice system can feel dehumanizing for both the victim and the defendant. They're caught in a web of law, told how to speak and behave by their attorneys, all in the name of justice. But there are other ways, approaches that can work alongside the existing justice system.
Or replace it entirely with a goal of reform.
We're talking about one of those alternatives today, restorative justice. North Carolina is poised to integrate this approach into its existing system, so we dug deep to find out what that means.
We interviewed prosecutors and public defenders, victims and perpetrators, all to learn how restorative justice really works. It's taken many forms in many places, but the basic concept is straightforward: to understand that crime harms individuals and communities, and to find ways a perpetrator can repair the harm they caused while being held accountable for their actions.
All right, but before we start really digging into this story, I thought it would be worth looking at what the justice system already does.
You would think that a victim has a lot of control over the process, but that's not necessarily the case. You see, during a criminal trial, the defendant is trying to prove their innocence, not take accountability. And it's the state on the other side of that court case, not the victim.
That's true. The victim ends up having their name in the public record alongside the perpetrator, even though they didn't do anything wrong. If it goes to trial, they might be cross-examined on the stand, which can be quite traumatizing, reliving your experience of a crime and having an attorney question your story.
Exactly. After a victim decides to come forward and cooperate with authorities, the only real thing that they have control over is a victim impact statement read into the record. They may not even get an apology. There's this split in the courtroom where they don't talk directly to the perpetrator.
And that defendant has no motivation to change that paradigm. They're innocent until proven guilty, and anything they say can and will be used against them.
But restorative justice is different. We heard all about it from John Powell, a law professor at Campbell University here in North Carolina. He's the director of the university's Restorative Justice Clinic and the state's preeminent expert on the topic. He's also the main mediator involved in every restorative justice pilot case in the state.
He's a quintessential Southern gentleman. He prefers a meeting to be held lingering over a pleasant lunch and says one of the joys of his job is getting to know people. He loves humanity, and that's part of the reason he values restorative justice.
Well, it's a theory of justice that understands that when crimes are committed, it's not just lawbreaking, but it affects people's lives, it affects relationships, it affects communities. And then there are practices that you can bring to get people involved in their own cases, their own situations, to address the harm that's been done, and to try to make amends as much as possible with that.
Powell started a restorative justice clinic with a colleague at Campbell in 2003. It started with youth because that's often more politically viable than offering these kinds of services for adults. The voting public seems much more willing to give kids second chances, but might have a harsher view of adult defendants.
And we started as a diversion program for the juvenile court. So juveniles that were accused of committing crimes could be diverted out to us, and we could work with them and their victims to try to rectify the harm that was done. And hopefully also, besides serving victims that way, serve offenders so that they could mend their ways and begin to act differently and get out of the system and not come back into it.
With kids in juvenile court, the crimes aren't quite as serious as the rape and murder cases we'll get into later this hour, but petty crimes and bullying can still hurt a community.
On the porch of a restaurant in Wallace, NC, Powell told us about the case of a young defendant who had broken into a family's garage.
So he broke in, he stole some things from them, he sold them, got his money, spent his money, and he was caught, and the family was offered our restorative justice program. It made sense to them because they did want to confront him and they wanted to tell him what he had done to them. It wasn't just that he had stolen their stuff. He had violated their trust. And so they no longer felt safe in their home knowing that somebody could break into their home and do that sort of thing.
The victims and the burglar, they got to know each other. This was all a carefully coordinated series of meetings mediated through the court system.
As a part of the resolution, he went to work. He earned money so that he could replace the things that he had stolen and sold that couldn't be recovered. They actually, at the end of the meeting that they had, the face-to-face meeting that they had, after we had prepared them in individual meetings to come together, they decided when they left, they were all hungry, so they went down to the Pizza Hut and had a pizza dinner together.
And they even went to a basketball game together. Powell says the kid learned his lesson.
And at least this particular young man had not gotten in trouble after that. We do find that that's the trend. We track it in the schoolwork that we do. Kids tend not to get suspended again, not to act out and fight again. In the criminal world, they tend not to offend criminally again. And that's pretty consistent with most restorative justice programs that you look at across the country and around the world.
According to the FBI, restorative justice programs nationwide show higher rates of victim satisfaction, lower recidivism, better restitution payoffs, and improved offender accountability. Longmont, Colorado, for example, had an 8% recidivism rate while employing the restorative justice concept. That's compared with up to 70% with the traditional punitive process.
It's an incredible result. But Powell doesn't find it surprising in the least.
To me, the magic potion is the relationship building. This young man understood what he had done to another human being, and so he didn't want to do that again. It makes a difference. I mean, I've always said I think relationship makes the difference. And we do spend a lot of time helping people to build relationship in our processes.
It's a very human view of the purpose of justice. And it might bother some people. It's a view of justice that asks what the goal of a justice system truly is. Is it punishment or is it reform? Do we want to simply punish wrongdoers or help them find a new way of being, a new way to define themselves?
It strikes me as a hopeful perspective on humanity. It considers the possibility that criminals aren't monsters, but humans who may regret their choices and wish to make amends.
But we've largely talked about lower-level crimes committed by kids and teenagers. It's easy to consider the hope of restitution in these cases, but how do you address the worst crimes of our society? Rape, murder, abuse, and other violent crimes.
Would a victim actually want to face the person who hurt them that badly? Think about it. Someone who violently assaulted them or killed a member of their family.
We've done a number of these cases over the years where we have murder cases, for example, where we've been able to exchange information and dialogue between victims and offenders, but we've never been allowed by the state to take a victim into the prison until last year. So that first case that we'll call our first pilot case was a rape case. Holly Gilmore was raped by Jimmy Jones. He broke into her apartment in Carrboro when she was a senior at Carolina, and he raped her, and it was a pretty violent crime. He's serving a life sentence now. After 30 years, she learned about some of his therapy, which part of it was that he spoke to an empty chair that represented his victim. And the therapy is, what would you say to your victim? Let's talk to the empty chair. When she saw a picture of that empty chair and some of the labels that were put on it, like hurt and shame and one thing that she said was, empty chairs don't represent me. Empty chairs represent people that have passed on, like we'll hold an empty chair at a wedding, for example, for somebody that's no longer there. I'm here. And if he's going to talk to something, he's going to talk to me. That was her motivation. And she said, I'm going to sit in the empty chair.
The first time I heard about this case, my jaw dropped. There's going to be a documentary about it. The entirety of the six-hour meeting between the two was filmed, and the documentarian has done follow-up interviews with the two.
It's hard to imagine going through something like that, reliving one of the worst days of your life, seated across from the person who did it to you. But Holly Gilmore did that, and then she told us about it. Holly is an incredibly brave woman who has spent most of her life helping people who've been hurt, much like she was. We talked to her over a Zoom call. The connection sometimes isn't the best.
Well, I've always wanted to help others, but I knew in my heart of hearts that I wanted to become involved in criminal cases and criminal investigations. And I wanted to work for the prosecutor's office, helping victims of sexual assault, physical assault. And so I started volunteering for the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office in September of 1992. And shortly thereafter, I received a paid position, and that is where I remain today, almost 32 years later.
She's spent decades helping child and adult victims of sexual assault and calls it some of the most rewarding work of her life.
In my job, it's very important to me that I not talk about what happened to me, not because I'm ashamed of it or embarrassed of it or I want to keep it to myself, not for those reasons at all, but because I never wanted to take away from anyone else's time. I never wanted to take away from their case.
But the reason Holly's doing this work across the country in Seattle and not in her home state of North Carolina is because of what happened to her on October 7th, 1990. It was her senior year at UNC Chapel Hill, and she had dreams of becoming a lawyer. But in the early morning hours that day, between 4 and 5 in the morning, a man named Jimmy Jones broke into her apartment through a roommate's window. The roommate wasn't home, but Jones stalked through the house until he found Holly and sexually and physically assaulted her.
After the rape occurred, the offender in my case was not arrested immediately. It took some time to locate him and to arrest him through DNA. And so I was living in fear, knowing that he was out in the community, and Chapel Hill, Carrboro, that area is very small. And I was terrified.
Her mother had moved to Seattle, so she followed her there. She graduated from college, but she never did end up going to law school.
That crime, it absolutely altered the trajectory of her life.
I remember going back to class the first day, and one of my professors just, he saw me, difficult time carrying on the class. He couldn't do it, and he excused the class early. He was sitting up in the front, and everybody knew what had happened, and it was just a very scary time for me because I didn't know where he was. I didn't know who he was. He was a total stranger to me. And so it was just a very frightening, scary time. And it had huge impacts on my future and what happened to me going forward. My dreams of going to law school at UNC were obliterated.
She spent the rest of her life looking over her shoulder, decades of therapy to cope with the trauma of that night. But then she heard through the grapevine about her attacker's therapy inside prison.
It's called SOAR, Sexual Offender Accountability and Responsibility, a program through the Department of Corrections. It's based on the idea that deviant sexual behavior is learned and that inappropriate behavior can be unlearned and substituted. It's not typical for a victim to find out about this, but Holly had started meeting with attorneys related to parole in the offender's case. So she got a detailed account of his therapy in prison.
The offender in my case was asked to speak to an empty chair. And during that time, he was to pretend that the victim was sitting in that chair.
That empty chair, the image of it, Holly hated it.
It had very negative words painted on it, like shame and disgust and danger, fear, all of these very negative words. I became, I don't want to say angry because there's really no anger here, but I became rather distraught.
She didn't see herself in that chair. She didn't see herself in the words painted on it. At the time, Holly had never heard about restorative justice. It was a totally new concept to her. But she decided that would be her way to move forward and heal.
If he wants to talk with me, he's not going to do it to an empty chair. I'm going to go and sit in that empty chair, and he can talk to me in person.
Friends told her not to do it, but she was determined. She just wanted answers. Why her? Was it premeditated? She hadn't gotten a lot of answers during the court case, and frankly, she wanted to face down the person she viewed as a monster.
But it didn't happen immediately. These kind of restorative justice meetings take a lot of preparation.
It takes a lot of work to make it happen successfully. And I knew that going in. I knew that we couldn't just walk into a prison and have a quick meeting. And I'm so glad because it was so helpful for me to have the support of so many people, including Kim Banco, John Powell, Joya Powell, Val Hansen, just everybody in the community who was on our team. We had a great team of people who helped me through this process. We had tremendous meetings throughout.
And that team was meeting with the perpetrator as well. He had to consent to the meeting too. It took years, especially since this all began during the COVID lockdown.
Almost every day, it became more and more important to me to finish it. So my goal really is to not only have this be important for me, but my goal was to help open the doors for other people so that it can be an option for others.
Finally, all the preparations were complete. Holly knew she wanted allies in the room with her, mediators, and the people she'd come to trust during her preparations. And she also had one important request, that she be the one to walk into the room and he be the one waiting for her, instead of him walking into her space like he did that awful night.
So it was very important to me that, no, he doesn't get that power and control over me ever again, that I get to set the parameters on that, and I'm going to walk in on him this time.
She did just that. After years of meetings and preparations, she flew back out to North Carolina. She went through security at the Orange Correctional Center and walked into the room with her victim's advocate, Kim Benko.
I sat down in that empty chair that I talked about earlier, and I was probably maybe 3 or 4 feet across from the man who had assaulted me 30 years prior.
I can only imagine how hard it was to walk through that door.
Quite honestly, I was shaking like a leaf. Part of me was scared to death, but there was also a part of me that, because of the support I had received, not only from our team, but also the support that I had received from my friends and counselors and support people here in Seattle, I walked in with strength, and I walked in with courage.
According to Holly, what she saw when she walked in was not a monster, but a man, although he still looked pretty monstrous to her.
It took me a minute I couldn't look him in the eyes. It took me a minute because the offender in my case has very distinct features, and there are facial features of his that are extremely frightening for me, and it was very difficult. But I also wanted to be very professional towards him. I wanted to be very respectful, and I wanted to be very cognizant of the fact that the offender in my case had to agree for this to happen just as much as I had to agree for this to happen.
She had a reason for coming into that room, though. She came in with 9 pages of questions prepared.
I said I wanted answers. I wanted the truth. And I wanted that. I wanted it to be successful. And that was absolutely the truth.
And Jones told her that he wanted her to see his humanity. They ended up spending 6 hours in that room, talking through everything that happened that day. And she did end up seeing his humanity over that time.
She got a lot of the answers she wanted, ranging from background about his childhood to what he did for work at the time that he broke into her apartment.
He listened to my questions. I think he tried to answer them. I think most of them were I think some of them were answered truthfully. I think a good portion of them were answered truthfully. My questions, again, were very chronological. I went from his early days as a child, like, what was it? What happened that made you become this monster that would do this to hurt people?
At the end of it all, Holly says it felt like a weight off her shoulders, and she found a new sense of strength.
I think the things I got back were a little bit more of my self-confidence. To know that I was able to go through this process and feel what I felt, and to know that he can't take away anything regarding myself. He can't take away my self-confidence, no matter what he does to me.
And that's something everyone can see in her now. John Powell saw it in her that day.
She just walks lighter. I mean, people that have known her all of her life will say, Holly, you're a different person. And these are people who are very skeptical about whether she should do this or not and would encourage her not to do it. And after she did it, they said, I'm sorry I ever said that, because you're a different person. This has helped you tremendously. So I just think it brings, it lets her let go of a lot of fear and anxiety and self-doubt. One thing that she said to Jimmy was that she was going to forgive herself. And Jimmy said, why would you feel like you need to forgive yourself? She said, I can forgive myself for losing the person that I was before you did this to me.
That experience doesn't necessarily mean she endorsed him getting out on parole, though. Holly doesn't think that question should even be asked of her.
The goal of a victim-offender dialogue is not about having the offender released. It's not about offering him forgiveness. It's about what you can find on the other end within yourself. And for that, I'm grateful.
I can really see how this experience helped Holly move on with her life. But I wonder what Jimmy Jones got out of it. Why would someone who did something so terrible want to see the person they hurt and enter into such an open conversation?
When we come back from this break, we'll hear from a perpetrator of a different violent crime, a man who murdered someone when he was 19 and spent the rest of his life behind bars. His experience on the other side of a victim-offender dialogue changed his life. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. You're listening to The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Kenoyer.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thanks for staying with us.
Today, we're talking about restorative justice, the idea that the justice system should aim to repair relationships and heal the pain caused by crime, allowing people to make amends. In the last segment, we heard from Holly Gilmore, a victim of a violent rape.
Holly mentioned that taking back the control she said was stolen from her was of high importance. She got to decide when, where, and how she wanted to confront her perpetrator. Holly never forgave Jones for what he did and what he had taken from her, but she did offer him grace.
Someone else may want to say, I forgive you, and that may be super important to that person. This can be their opportunity. Or another victim may just want to see the offender. Maybe the offender took the life of her loved one, his or her loved one. And they may just want to lay eyes on that person and say, what was my loved one's last words? What did they do in those last moments of their life? They may just want to have answers to those questions.
Maybe Jones wanted forgiveness or redemption. Or maybe he just thought Holly deserved answers after all these years. But we do know that, in some cases, these conversations can be equally as cathartic for the offender.
A lot of people truly regret their crimes. That's what we heard from one prisoner who committed a murder when he was 19. He's still incarcerated today.
My name is Thorny Cooper. I am 49 years old.
Thorny has bright eyes, a wide smile, and great posture. He greeted mediator John Powell warmly when they saw each other. But he was nervous to talk with two reporters, especially about such a difficult topic. He was more wary of us two reporters than the correctional staff around him.
I'm so nervous. I'm so sorry.
But meeting in the chapel at Sampson Correctional, he seemed determined to offer transparency.
Thorny participated in the second case of restorative justice inside a prison in North Carolina. Attorney John Powell says he's a kind soul.
Well, I only know Thorny as a 50-some-year-old man. I did not know him as an 18 or 19-year-old, and I think he was 19 when he committed the crime that got him the life sentence that he got. When I met him, he was a very remorseful, humble person who wanted to do anything he could to apologize and make amends with Andre's family.
Thorny Cooper was sentenced to life in prison for first-degree murder nearly 30 years ago for the shooting death of Andre Watkins. Andre died from his injuries a few weeks after the shooting, so in this case, he met with the victim's sister and his daughter.
But let's start with the murder itself. Thorny told us he never planned to kill Andre. Instead, he had been targeted by a group of young men all throughout his last year of high school.
I guess you could say I was pretty much bullied. I was under a lot of pressure, and I really didn't know how to really deal with that situation. And I had plenty of time to think about that.
Details of the crime were sparse at the time. An article in the March 7th, 1995 edition of the Star News explains that Thorny had been attacked by three men on Castle Street months earlier. The shooting victim was one of those men who'd attacked him because they wanted his leather jacket.
Thorny says he dealt with each incident as it came, getting beaten up, having some possessions stolen. Then he went to a friend's apartment one day, and there was Andre, one of the people who'd been attacking him.
Thorny says he was afraid, but he also didn't have the tools to make a better decision or to act off of anything other than adrenaline. His mother said as much in the 1995 Star News article. She told the reporter she'd taught her son that if you get me, I'll get you back.
I was socialized at an early age to believe a man, you know, doesn't take his problem home. He deal with it. And I subscribe to that toxic thinking. So I'm 18 years old. I encountered an ugly situation, and I didn't want to take that problem home. I can deal with it. I'm a man I'm supposed to deal with. So that was kind of like the stinking thinking. And I dealt with that situation. I was attacked about three times, and each occasion, I dealt with it. I wasn't really vocal about it. And I was actually in a state of depression. I was just keeping all this stuff in. And this is stuff that I've learned after the fact. At that time, 18, 19 years old, I'm not really processing like how I'm processing now. So it was a lot going on in my mind at that time that I didn't know how to deal with. I didn't know how to ask for help. It was pressure.
Thorny's mother may have offered ill-guided advice in this case, but she was not wrong in wanting her son to be able to fend for himself as a young Black man living in the South. For added context, sticking up for yourself by any means necessary is a principle held by many within the Black community. This ideal arises in response to generational trauma due to decades of racially motivated violence. But this credo often perpetuates violence within the community it was set in place to protect.
That was evident on that day in 1995. Thorny went to an apartment at Gervais Place looking for a friend, and says he was surprised to find one of the men who had previously attacked him there. In his shock, he says he shot him and then ran. He threw the gun in the trash and was soon apprehended.
It was random. It wasn't like planned, like I know this particular person going to be here and this person going to be here and this is what I'm going to do. It was like a in-your-face moment how you're going to respond. And that was the reaction. And my behavior, for the most part, was motivated by fear.
Thorny says he immediately regretted what he'd done. And when Andre died in the hospital a few weeks later, Thorny was devastated.
When I found out that the person that I'm incarcerated passed away, it was like, I guess you can say my foundation fell beneath me. Like, this is serious. It's like, if it's the worst thing a person can do, it was taking, you know, being responsible for another person's life being removed from the earth.
Thorny says he found salvation early on during his life sentence. He quickly accepted the word of God and got baptized. He marks that as the beginning of his spiritual journey, but he didn't feel saved.
One of the first things when I got saved, when I confessed my sins, would God, or does God forgive a murderer? And I don't like the word. I really don't want to be associated with that. So would God forgive someone that did what I did? And there was a lot of shame associated with that.
Thorny has been an exemplary prisoner, according to his attorney and correctional staff who've spoken with us. He's worked as a teacher's assistant to help students with learning disabilities. He's president of the Men's Alliance Club, which aims to boost morale and help inmates improve their leadership and communication skills. And he started a birthday ministry, giving birthday cards to inmates who don't receive them.
I know God created me to be just a loving, compassionate, caring person. That's just who I am. I feel most alive when I'm helping people. That's who God created me to be. That's one of my purposes.
Thorny got a life sentence and spent his time in prison trying to become a better man. He never saw release in his future, but set out to be the best person he could be. But now, Thorny has a chance at release. Assistant Public Defender Max Ashworth was assigned to handle Thorny's post-conviction claim. And just a disclosure notice, Ashworth is running for Superior Court judge this year.
From 1995 to 1998, North Carolina law allowed for judicial review of life sentences at the 25-year mark. That law was repealed, but Thorney was convicted during that brief period. That meant he was eligible for judicial review, which got him a public defender. Ashworth sought parole for him through the process in 2022, but the recommendation was denied.
But Ashworth didn't want to let it go. He thought Thorney was uniquely kind and remorseful and would be a good candidate for restorative justice. Ashworth had seen it in practice at the Restorative Justice Clinic while attending Campbell Law School. He says he saw something special in Thorney.
It's not just a court file. These are people's lives. And, you know, Thorney expressed to me this concern that he just didn't feel whole after this has happened. He didn't feel like himself. He felt like something was missing. So, I mean, I have this tool, restorative justice. I know about it. I know who to contact to put it in place. And, you know, that's just what we did.
Ashworth reached out to John Powell and First Assistant District Attorney Barrett Temple to help Thorney pursue restorative justice. But first, they had to get the victim on board.
I mean, I've had other cases where I knew that it was just not appropriate. The restorative justice was just not appropriate because the offender's mindset wasn't right for it, and the victim's mindset just wasn't right for it. It was way too hostile, but this was kind of a good balance of, you know, being upset, having questions that the victim's having questions that won't to get answered, and a desire for closure. And it was just kind of the perfect combination for it to happen.
In this case, the victims were intrigued and started the process of meeting with Powell to learn more. Thorney never thought he'd get the chance to talk with the victim's family. But when he was offered that chance, he was elated.
I don't think they had any idea about the process. In 2024, restorative justice was introduced to me. I was asked, would I be interested? I didn't know nothing about it, but when I learned I will be sitting down with the victim's family, it was for healing and forgiveness, I was totally for it.
Before meeting with the sister and daughter of Andre Watkins, John Powell vetted Thorney to make sure he had no ulterior motives. Powell says the family hoped to get something out of the conversation, like many victims do.
So they need information. They need to know that someone has remorse, for example. They need to know that people feel sorry for what they've done and want to make amends. And so offenders that are appropriate are those people. And so when they find out about this, most of the offenders that I have met with are so grateful that a victim wants to enter into this process.
But the conversation was in no way an interrogation. Powell prompted Thorney to recall the event to determine whether Thorney was truly remorseful. And he was.
And he challenged me, and I'm thankful for that challenge because he challenged me to go down some path that I didn't want to go down, that I probably needed to go down, because it's something I can never forget. And it's something that I think it's the rehabilitation tool that's needed in the Department of Public Safety. Because at the end of the day, I feel like whatever the nature of the crime, you have to fully empathize with what you did.
Thorney was remorseful, but he was anxious in equal measure the day of the meeting. When he saw Andre's sister, he tried his best to understand how she felt.
She was really looking for, like, what to say. And in the process of her finding the right words to say, it touched me because it was like, just by observing her facial expression, I actually saw when she went to that place of darkness, that place of pain. It started showing her facial expression. And it like, when she shifted or thought, went to another place, I seen that in her facial expression. So I knew there was some conflict in thought just by observing her facial expression. And that did something to me. That stirred me up, come like, I was hurting for her. I was really, really hurting for her. And it was like, if I could just take it all away, I would. I'm a big hugger. I just want to if I can just hug you and everything would just vanish, that's what I wanted to do. And she eventually found her words, and she spoke to the fact, like, prior to actually walking through the gate, she had second thoughts about actually following through, and something told her to move forward. It was hard for her. and she talked about what her brother meant to her.
Thorny listened intently across the table, processing every word she said. But then, the victim did something Thorny was not expecting at all. She talked about her brother, how losing him hurt her. And then
she surprised me after sharing, you know, with her brother. You know, she said, like, you know, she's not angry. I'm not angry with you. I am hurt. And I think she followed that, you know, I just want you to know, maybe not in these exact words, but pretty much she extended forgiveness. And that was like off the script, so unexpected. So when that came out, it was like, broke me completely down.
John Powell told us he had no idea she was going to do that when he drove her to the prison that day. She said she decided in the car that she needed to forgive him. We're withholding these family members' names, by the way, because they wanted privacy and declined to be interviewed. Thorny says he could hardly even process what she said. He was so shocked. He broke down. Even recalling it, he gets emotional.
I was like, broke me down. I was no more good. I was no more good. Like, this is not supposed to be the process. You're supposed to be angry with me. You're supposed to be yelling at me. You're supposed to be crying. Like, you extended forgiveness.
It took him a while to come back down to earth. He was so elated. But he also had to answer questions, much like Holly asked questions of Jimmy Jones.
Yeah, I mean, why did I go to this particular apartment the day that I went to? And I pretty much thought I went looking for a friend. And I was actually going to share more information. And it was like she had things in perspective too. No matter what you say, nothing can undo the damage that's been done. And I don't need that right now, because at the end of the day, what's been taken away from me is not going to be brought back. So it's like, she spared me. She really spared me from going down a dark path. And I was very grateful because I didn't want to go down that path.
It was like magic in that room. Even the warden of the prison was absolutely compelled by what he saw. John Powell recalls it with joy.
She continued in her conversation, and she got to another point that she stopped. And she looked at me, and she said, "Can I hug him?" I'm like, "Yeah." And I don't have the authority to tell her that in that room. The warden was the one that had the authority. And as soon as I said, "Yeah," I thought, I don't have that authority. I looked over at the warden, and he was going, "Yeah, that's okay." They both stood up and embraced. And I mean, it was a warm hug that lasted a while, and more tears. So those were a couple of things I absolutely did not expect. But quite frankly, it is not uncommon when you make a space for people to be human and to be themselves. The courtroom is not that place. I mean, there's a separation. You don't speak, you don't admit, that sort of thing. But in this moment, they both kind of knew where their hearts were.
The family was so compelled by their meetings with Thorny that they vouched for him at his parole hearing. The judge recommended parole, which means his case can move forward towards release. It's not guaranteed, but according to Ashworth, the parole board is interviewing Andre's family, reviewing Thorny's court files and prison records to come up with a parole recommendation that will be sent to the governor's office. The process will take 5 or 6 months and was only made possible because of the support from the victim's family.
While Thorny's possible release is a joyful occasion for him and his family, it's not the goal of restorative justice. That is to reconcile and give victims what they need.
Anytime something like this is implemented, people will hopefully not try to abuse it too much, but it has the potential to be abused. But the good thing about restorative justice is you can't push it on people. It has to come naturally.
Next up, a look at how restorative justice will become an integrated part of the Department of Corrections in North Carolina. You are listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thanks for tuning in.
Today, we're talking about restorative justice, the idea that crime causes division and pain in a community, and it's on the perpetrator to make amends and heal those wounds through reconciliation. It requires an open mind and an open heart, both on the part of the victim and the perpetrator.
In the last segment, we told you the story of Thorny Cooper, who killed a young man named Andre Watkins in Wilmington when he was 19. Thorny has worked with Andre's sister for the past 2 years and had an emotional meeting with her, where she forgave him for his crime. And this past summer, he was granted a parole recommendation that now goes to the governor's office for consideration. He might soon be eligible for parole.
So much planning goes into these restorative justice cases. It's a careful, cautious process of contacting the two parties and preparing them with counseling sessions and meetings over the course of months or years.
But it's more than that. Other than the mediator and the two parties, prison personnel need to agree to the meeting and coordinate it.
That last element is why the two cases we've discussed in this episode were one of a kind. Previous restorative justice cases have all been by phone or by letters because the prison system, until recently, thought it was inappropriate. Letting victims in with the people who hurt them? No way.
These pilot cases changed that, though. Now, restorative justice is about to become a codified part of the Victim Services Division in North Carolina.
That's partially thanks to Governor Roy Cooper, who created a task force for racial equity in criminal justice. They recommended the creation of restorative justice programs throughout the state, with an emphasis on victim-offender dialogue programs.
Kim Banco is the Victim Support Services Director with the North Carolina Department of Adult Correction. She is one of the driving forces pushing to codify restorative justice in our state.
This is a way for a victim to find meaning of what happened to them and maybe get answers to questions or to tell the impacts of the crime and just have a conversation with the offender.
She says over 30 states currently run victim-offender dialogue programs, and they vary quite a lot by state. Texas probably has the largest programs in the country and serves as a model for other states that are developing their own.
I have always wanted to see this done, but no, we have tried in years past, and it just wasn't the right time with administrations. You know, every 4 years we get a new governor and so things change from the top down. But this pilot program was at a time when the governor had his task force, the TREC task force, and they got wind of it and jumped on it, and it's just gotten out there.
Banco and the adult corrections team are in the middle of forming a full-fledged victim offender dialogue program.
I drafted a policy, and it is now going through review through our policy management section. So once that gets the approval and it passes legal and everything, then I will try to work on how best to get the word out and get outreach out there.
Benko hopes the North Carolina program will be up and running by the end of the year. She says it fills an important niche for the system, giving victims back control.
Once something goes to court or to trial, it's the state versus the offender. It's not the victim versus the offender. And so the state takes over, and then whatever happens, happens. And I know that victims have input, but it's probably not as much as they want.
John Powell, the law professor at Campbell University who really spearheaded restorative justice in this state, says the program will remain human-centric and extremely cautious, and it'll be codified that way. That's because there's risk involved with putting a victim and offender together in person.
If I don't think the offender is appropriate for the situation, I'm going to tell them that, and I'm going to help them make an informed choice about whether they can get what they need. Because sometimes if offenders are still in that bad place, they're going to do what they can to hurt them again, hurt somebody again, and I don't want to be a part of that. But my general go-to is case-by-case basis, let the victim make informed decisions about whether they want to continue or not.
There are certain crimes that won't be eligible for this program in North Carolina, domestic violence being the main one. Banco says there's too much risk involved.
Because it's such a volatile relationship to begin with, and there's already a lot of manipulation and control in those type of relationships with those dynamics, and so we don't want what we see as a one-time meeting as a means to start other dialogues and meetings, and that is not the intent or the purpose of the program, and we certainly don't want to endanger a victim any more than they already have been.
The idea is really for this to be a one-time meeting, not something that continues on. Benko is a longtime victims advocate and now has been trained to be a facilitator for these kinds of conversations, a neutral party supporting both people in the victim-offender dialogue. She says making that switch has been hard.
I'm such a big advocate, you know. So this is putting on a different hat, and it is different, but it's a good difference. So it is very, very rewarding. I love what I do.
But the key in this entire program is still to keep the control of the situation firmly in the victim's hands. The program will be available on the Victim Support Services website, and they plan to make pamphlets with more information. But it all has to come from the victim first.
And if we think they're a good candidate, then we'll go and see if the inmate is a good candidate before we even go and talk to the offender about the program. It has to be voluntary for both parties, and it has to be victim initiated, so we're not going to take anything that comes from an offender. And that's just to make sure it's a pure process.
Holly Gilmore, the survivor from the start of the show, was an ideal candidate in many ways. She's such a strong person, and she was extraordinarily motivated to complete this program. And that's for one important reason. Holly is fighting cancer.
I have stage 4 breast cancer that has metastasized into my spine. I have multiple compression fractures in my spine. I have tumors that are growing in basically every bone in my body.
Such a serious diagnosis can really clarify a person's priorities, and that was certainly the case for Holly.
My diagnosis did not at all deter me from stopping this project. It was too important to me, and over time, almost every day, it became more and more important to me to finish it.
For Holly, this meeting was a chance to prove to herself how strong she truly is.
I walked in with strength, and I walked in with courage, and I walked in with everything I had in me. And at that point, I had stage 4 cancer, and I knew that it might be the last time I ever do something like this. But I also knew how important it was, not only for me, but for others. And I'm very proud that I was the first one. And I want my story told. I no longer want this case to be a file on a shelf in a prosecutor's office or in the Department of Adult Correction gathering dust. I want my case open. I want people to hear it. I want people to know what he did. I want people to know how traumatizing it was for me, how it continues to be that for me. But I also want them to know that this process can be very positive.
And thanks to her commitment and her hard work, this pilot program will be available to victims across the state. Kim Benko and John Powell will facilitate as many cases as they can. And Powell can call on resources across North Carolina. He's created a network of restorative justice professionals who are already engaged in victim-offender dialogues.
Arguably, justice is done when a conviction is handed down. But healing begins when victims can take their power back. Any victims hearing this who are interested in participating can reach out to the Victim Services Department to get involved.
That's about all the time we have left for the newsroom. Thank you for listening. Thanks also to our editor, Ben Schockman, and programming manager, Ken Campbell.
Special thanks to all our guests this hour, John Powell, Kim Benko, Max Ashworth, Holly Gilmore, and Thorny Cooper. And thank you to Warden Robert Van Gorder at Sampson Correctional, who facilitated our visit with Thorny.
If you have questions about today's programming or ideas for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it at whqr.org or get the show as a podcast pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts. I'm Kelly Knoyer.
And I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thanks again for listening to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media.